Welcome to Talking History. I am Richard Hamm. Today we have Alan Taylor, professor of history from University of California at Davis. Professor Taylor is author of three books, Liberty Men and Great Proprietors, William Cooper's Town, and most recently, The American Colonies, which is the first in the projected five-volume set of History of the United States. Professor Taylor has won numerous prizes, including the Pulitzer Prize for William Cooper's Town. Alan, welcome to Talking History. You're a scholar of the frontier.
Guilty as charged.
Is it a frontier that we, you know, the people who watch the History Channel would recognize, or is it a broader concept of frontier? How would you define frontier?
Well, I guess the History Channel, you'd primarily have in mind the American West, the Gold Rush, that sort of thing. I'm interested in the early American frontier from the late 18th century into the 19th century. It's the frontier of Daniel Boone, so that's probably familiar to viewers.
It's often called the backcountry, and you say that there are certain aspects of the backcountry that seem to replicate over time, even though the space is often different. There's a cultural space of the backcountry.
Mm-hmm. I'm primarily a historian of British America in the 18th century, which becomes the United States with the American Revolution in 1776. So the West for that particular political entity was found at the Appalachian Mountains. Everything beyond that, the Ohio Valley, the Great Lakes, the Mississippi Valley, that was all the West for these people. And from their perspective, it's the back country because it's back of the settled landscape along the Atlantic seaboard. Now, of course, this is a frontier region that will move as population expands over the Appalachians and into the interior of the continent. And this goes to a concept that Frederick Jackson Turner made famous, that American history, at least until the late 19th century, is a process of this moving, replicating frontier that is ever moving westward.
But sometimes it doesn't just move westward. Sometimes it moves northeastward, as it did in Maine in the late 18th and early 19th century, as you cover in your first book.
That's quite right. So the predominant movement is westward, but people are probing for opportunities to have farms in all directions. And so certainly to the northeast into Maine, to the north into Vermont, and into the northwest to go into Canada. And that is the subject of my current research. It is the nature of migration that is transcending the new border established by the American Revolution between the British Empire in Canada and the United States to the south of that border.
Okay. Before we get to your current research, let's go back to some of your earlier research. And in fact, the American Revolution is somewhat a pivotal event in both of your monographic works in situating what happens in, I don't even want to call them communities because you're really trying to get beyond communities, but you do study communities in the communities and everything that interrelates with them.
Right. The American Revolution has been at the very center of my work. In a way, it's kind of a black hole because I haven't written that much about the revolution per se. I'm more interested in either the causes or the consequences of that revolution, so I haven't been a military historian of the conflict itself. But I've been interested in the grand old question of what difference did the American Revolution make? Did it change the nature of American society? Was there some sort of social conflict within the American Revolution, or was the revolution simply a conflict with an external enemy, the British Empire? And I have come down on the side of seeing social conflict within the American Revolution and have then assessed the consequences of that revolution in terms of how those internal conflicts have played out within the story of the external conflict with the British Empire.
So, for instance, on the Maine frontier, it plays out in a struggle between the great proprietors and people who call themselves the Liberty Men, or later they call themselves the White Indians.
Right. On the Maine frontier of the 1780s, 90s, into the early 19th century, I found a classic case of internal conflict within the revolution, in that the people who owned the land, they claimed, by thousands of acres, they were known as great proprietors. Many of them were Revolutionary War commanders, people like General Henry Knox, General Washington's commander of artillery. After the revolution, he ends up claiming thousands of acres on this frontier, which had been settled by common soldiers and their families. These common soldiers and their families believed they ought to get free land from the process of clearing the forest, creating farms, in a landscape which had previously, before the revolution, had belonged to loyalists. And so their conviction is the loyalists lost the land. They were soldiers of the revolution, or families of soldiers of the revolution. Their reward for going on to the land and clearing it with backbreaking labor ought to be free farms. But Henry Knox, who had obtained the legal rights from these loyalists, insisted that the revolution was not going to produce this kind of social change, that instead there would be continuity of property rights. And he was there to enforce his property rights by compelling these settlers to purchase their farms from him.
You have been talking, it's come through in everything you've said so far, because you deal in this early time period, the central issue is always, it seems, beyond political power and cultural differences, it's land. I mean, you really are in some ways a historian of land, and in your monographic works, you have long passages describing and assessing the land. I mean, you feel like you can almost envision the land from what you write about it.
Yes, that's very much the case. I grew up in rural Maine. I grew up with a great interest in landscape, in environment, in climate, how these affect people, how people adapt to these facts of life. And it's always been compelling to my imagination to try to understand a culture with a much simpler technology, the challenges of people resting their living out of a difficult land and a difficult climate, such as my ancestors experienced in rural Maine at the end of the 18th and early 19th century. And I think then this is helpful to me to understand this particular period of time when over 95% of Americans got their living out of the earth as farmers working with hand tools to get their living out of that very grudging earth, especially in New England.
And you don't romanticize the labor or the effect of, if we could call it, pioneering. You show it to be backbreaking labor that has certain consequences for these people.
Yeah, I find the reality to be far more compelling, if grimmer, than some sort of romanticization that would suggest that this is an easy life, getting your living out of the soil, given the technology of the late 18th century. These were hard people dealing with a hard environment.
And so also in central New York, it's not exactly an Eden there for the people who come into William Cooper's grandiose plan of building a civilization in the wilderness.
That's certainly the case, though it's a step up from New England. There are fewer rocks and more fertility to be found in central New York. But farmers discovered in central New York, especially in the second generation of trying to run a farm, that that plowing the soil of this hilly upcountry tended to diminish its fertility. So often they were kind of lulled by the immediate experience of harvesting the soil that had not been intensely cultivated before. Crops looked pretty good, life was looking much better, and then they would experience the degradation of the soil under continuous cultivation, and many of them would then go bust and have to move elsewhere.
Your work also contributes to the ongoing debate of how capitalist America was early on. You don't run right into the polemical battles. You skirt them rather nicely, but you actually put evidence out that I would say people on both sides claim for their own about how people perceived what they were doing when they were settling, whether they were squatting or settling these lands.
And I think that's quite right. That's an enormous question that I don't want to make at the very center of my work, because I think it's been polarized in stereotypical ways, and I don't want to be caught in either the stereotypes that would suggest, on the one hand, either that these were all John D. Rockefellers on the make, or on the other hand, to suggest that these were people who were somehow averse to the market. I see the market as a pervasive reality in the world of these farmers of the late 18th, early 19th century, one to which most of them are trying to do their best to get ahead within that market. But I don't want to suggest that that's the be-all and end-all of their motives in life. Some of these same people are also quite devout Christians. They certainly are devoted to their families. In some ways, these particular values can get in the way of just being pure rational maximizers of the stereotype of the market pervades all. So I am trying to be nuanced in looking at this world to see that the market and other values are shaping the behavior of these people.
Indeed, there's a constellation of values that come into the white Indian movement. I mean, religion becomes a very important part of it. Evangelical religion, it's hard to give an exact word, but it's definitely much more emotional than their congregational roots had been. And it also is not established as the Massachusetts Church was at the time.
That's quite right. Most of these people had come from southern New England, from Massachusetts, Rhode Island, or Connecticut. They had been moving out of a religious culture in which the congregational church was predominant, highly institutionalized, very well-educated ministry. Ministry that assumed that they ought to be in control of their parishes and that the congregations ought to be relatively passive. People are moving out of that. They're moving to the frontier. There are no churches when they get there. Initially, they can't afford the kind of expensive establishment that was mandated in Massachusetts to pay for a salaried minister, to build a church, to build a steeple. And so they develop much more spontaneous forms of religious expression, the kind of evangelical emotional faith that we associate with frontier revivalism that thrived in Maine, it thrived in central New York, it thrived in Kentucky, largely in the absence of this more institutionalized, more orthodox forms of faith. And that kind of spontaneous culture provided opportunities for people who were visionaries, who insisted that they had had direct encounter with angels, who insisted they had the gift of prophecy. And these people then are able to, in a way, craft their own variants of Christianity, which are often to the taste of these people who have moved there and who find that this is liberating. But this kind of spontaneous energy could not be sustained in the long term, and it's quite controversial because, of course, regular religious authorities will denounce these kinds of visionaries as charlatans, and will try to clamp down on this and will try to introduce regular churches.
Indeed, they will introduce regular churches, but those regular churches will have to exist side by side with what they would have called irregular churches. And in fact, in new forms of Christianity, because the very terms you use are obviously the very values that were at the core of the Latter-day Saints movement that comes out of Central New York.
That's quite right. These people who are moving to the frontier, they are creating new opportunities for themselves in culture as well as on the land as farms. And many of them become quite engaged with the process of having greater authority over their own spiritual lives. That said, some of these people, as they start to prosper, they want to have the respectability that is associated with the more established forms of Christianity. And these people then are kind of eager to get a salaried minister and a nice church and to have decorum in worship rather than these spontaneous outbursts. So that you get a much more mixed picture over time. So the religious landscape that you would find in central Maine or central New York come the early 19th century would be far more diverse than what these people had experienced growing up in Massachusetts or Connecticut. There wouldn't just be one predominant church. Some places you'd have an established church like the Presbyterians or the Episcopalians, but in other communities you'll find new forms, more spontaneous forms, Free Will Baptists, Methodists, and then forms of religion that seem to have emerged de novo, such as Joseph Smith and his early Mormon church, which emerged in central New York in the late 1820s, early 1830s.
to go from religion to the state and to law, because the tales that you have told are always intertwined with law, because after all, the great proprietors or William Coopers, very beginning, start with that they have a legal title to the land. For William Cooper, of course, it's sad he actually doesn't have a good legal title to the land, it turns out, eventually. But they have a legal title to the land, and they are in conflict, really, because they have the law on their side with the people who are on the land.
That's right. We have this vision, perhaps from the History Channel, that when people moved to the frontier, that they got free land. And that, by and large, is not true in American history. Much later in American history, in 1862, you do get the Homestead Act that does provide this kind of process. But even after 1862, most people who move to the frontier are not getting their land freely from the federal government. And in the period that I study, if you move to the frontier and you lay claim to land, odds are you're going to have to purchase that land from a proprietor in order to get title. Otherwise, you are a squatter, and you are subject to the legal power that that proprietor has, because he can hold a piece of paper up that gives him title. And that title comes from the sovereign. In theory, that sovereign was ultimately the King of England, but it then gets translated through a particular colony or a particular state that will award this and did not ordinarily award it directly to farmers. Instead, awarded it to politically well-connected people who had money, who had obtained the title to wilderness tracts of land before significant numbers of settlers had moved in there, and they're expecting to make a profit by retailing access to farm-sized parcels of land to the actual people who will settle on it and clear that land and make it into a farm.
Now, sometimes they want to sell it directly, but often they would the great proprietors wanted to have tenants, and there is almost a prejudice against being a tenant amongst many Americans at this point.
Well, the dream then was certainly to be your own proprietor, even if it's on the small scale of your own farm. That is the ideal for most American families. There was a very negative connotation to be a dependent, to be dependent on an employer. So to work for wages was acceptable in the short term, but people wanted that to be as short a term as possible. And the goal of working for wages for most rural people was to try to save some money up and then move either west or north, wherever you could have access to the frontier, and then try to obtain land as cheaply as possible, and then clear the land, grow crops, sell the crops, try to pay off the title on your land through the process of developing the potential of that land.
In other words, taking wilderness and making it civilization.
That's right, as they would call it. Now, of course, Native peoples didn't quite see it that way. They thought that they were just as well civilized as anybody, and certainly the behavior of some of these settlers struck them as quite barbarous. But this was the language that was used to justify taking land away from Native peoples and then environmentally transforming that land into a landscape that was profitable to this arriving culture.
And the law facilitated this in some ways. I mean, it facilitated the claims of the proprietors of the land. They had the common law on their side. They had title. Title gave them the action of ejectment, which could eject any tenants or people found on the land and took any improvements they had. This is the improvements become one of the contested terrains between the people who are on the land and the people who hold title to the land, yes?
That's right. But there, in practice, a compromise usually was worked out in that many people would move onto land, wilderness land, start to clear it, build a log cabin, put up some fences. These are all known as improvements, because the concept is that the land in its wilderness state isn't particularly valuable. It gets improved by labor invested in it to change it, to render agriculture possible, to render it relatively safe to keep livestock on it, to produce hay for the livestock, to be able to grow some grain that you could market, especially wheat. Of course, then the landlord will show up and say, well, you've been farming on my land and you have to buy title from me if you want to stay on this farm, or I'm going to sue you to eject you. And of course, the law is entirely on the side of this proprietor. But it's kind of bad business to just kick these people out who have been increasing the value of the land. So the general understanding was that if you found these kinds of squatters and their labor was creating additional value, that you would pay them something to go away. You're buying their improvements. And you're generally buying them cheaper than it would cost you to hire people to go and clear this land or build a cabin or put the fences up. So it's actually to your benefit, because then you can turn around and you can take this partially improved farm and sell it for a premium to some newcomer who has more money than the first wave of settlers tended to have. So in this kind of process, a kind of understanding was worked out in most places between this first wave of settlers, who are often squatters, their landlords, and then the second wave of settlers, who tend to be more prosperous people who don't want to undergo the severe hardships of that first encounter with a wilderness landscape.
But sometimes there isn't compromise. Compromise doesn't work out there. Sometimes the proprietors are, as they were in Central Maine, they had a patriarchal vision and a hierarchical vision of the world, and they don't want to compromise at first. They want to insist on their rights. And the people who are living on the land have come together in a mutual society in some ways. They bound together in a small community, and they're willing to resist to a certain point, even to the point of violence.
Yes, there are pockets on the American frontier where communities of these so-called squatters will develop an ideology which insists that because of their labor invested in the land, why should they have to pay somebody who's really done nothing or very little to help them, and nothing really to develop this land. So they develop this labor theory of value. They don't have to read some sort of radical ideologue to get this. They develop it out of their experience on the land. And in certain pockets, this kind of community building develops around this kind of belief system, and they would organize militias basically to defend their farms, so that they would not be evicted, they would not be ejected, because they did not buy the title of these outsiders. Central Maine is a classic case of this, and part of the problem there was that the proprietors had overlapping claims. So as a farmer, you were facing three or four people coming to you saying, you must buy my title. And that's pretty daunting when you're just barely scraping by. You're going to be much more tempted by a belief that says, I already own my land because of the labor that I and my family have put into turning this forest into a farm.
There's an analogy in New York with the patroonships and the anti-rent struggles of the 1840s to the 1860s. It's a very similar process in some ways.
There is. The anti-rent movement really built out of sort of, you can imagine, two types of resentment. One is that these great landlords refused to sell their land. They would only rent it. And that's okay for a while, maybe the first generation, and they attract poor people that can't really afford to buy land, and renting land is cheaper. But when you get the next generation comes along, and the previous generation has put a lot of labor into this land, increasing its value, they don't want to pay a higher rent without the option to buy it so they can become owners in their own right. And when they're blocked in that by landlords, there's a great deal of resentment. It seems un-American to keep people in this kind of economic dependence when they have the means to buy their farm. The other problem is that these landlords had used creative surveying to expand their domains. So they were much larger than they ought to have been. And people who found themselves then on the margins of these inflated domains called into question the legality of this creative surveying that obliges them to pay rent rather than obtain full and complete ownership of the land.
And indeed, they turn to the political process to bring them redress. In central Maine, they do it. In New York, they do it. And in Kentucky and Tennessee, even earlier, they did it. They turn to the state to fulfill their dream of what they thought the revolution should be.
They do that, and they're met halfway by certain politicians who are, of course, looking for votes and are offering partial redress. In none of these situations do these common farmers get everything that they seek, and they are almost always settling for a half loaf or maybe even a quarter loaf. But it is the case that in central New York, most people who have the means and would like to buy their farms, a procedure is provided for that. But they are not getting free farms.
They don't get free farms. They're not the big winners in the struggle. The original proprietors or the original landlords aren't the winners in the struggle. Who are the winners in these struggles, then?
Well, as I tend to tell it, it's the lawyers who are the big winners. So it's a classic case of American history. It's the people who are essential to the process of either through the law or through politics of trying to broker these disputes. They are the people that seem to be in the best position at the end of the two or three generation process that I've described.
Okay. The leading men who are often the intermediaries in communities who will decide, well, we should be taking the offer that's out there. We should be buying it at a dollar an acre at this point. They benefit in the short term, don't they?
They do. What you have in these kinds of conflicts is, on the one hand, you need to have a community solidarity, a notion that everybody's going to stick together. Nobody's going to break ranks if the proprietor offers special terms to a few. And maintaining that solidarity is pretty tricky, particularly because some people are going to be more prosperous farmers than others, and the more prosperous farmers are going to be more anxious about getting a secure title. They're also going to be the people that you look to for some leadership of the local community. So it's going to be in the interest of the proprietors, if you're trying to break up the community solidarity, you're going to appeal primarily to those people who have more influence. So those leading men in these frontier communities, these more prosperous farmers or millers, they are the people that are under the greatest pressure from their neighbors, but also from the outside proprietors. And it is their allegiance that's going to primarily be in play, and it's when they will swing away from community solidarity that this kind of resistance weakens and compromises become essential.
In central Maine, there doesn't seem to be a memory of these struggles as much as there was, say, in central New York or even in Kentucky and Tennessee about this. There doesn't seem to be a folklore. And in Williams Cooperstown, you actually look at the historical memory of this as told through the voice of James Fenimore Cooper, who fictionalizes his father's life in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in central Maine, to go to that case, there was a willful forgetting of the kind of violence associated with this resistance. Only one person got killed, but a fair number of people got roughed up. People had their barns burned down. They got driven away. Horses got shot. Horses got mutilated. Fences got knocked down. In some cases, these were local community leaders who were straying and then were being disciplined by their neighbors, or they are deputy sheriffs coming in trying to evict farm families and get a very rough treatment by people who are dressing up as Indians. None of this was what people of the mid-19th century wanted to remember about their grandparents. And in many cases, the people who are most active in this kind of rough justice had moved on. and had been replaced by newcomers. And the newcomers wanted to remember much more peaceful origins for their communities, much more respectable origins. So there is a willful forgetting, which my book, Liberty Men and Great Proprietors, was attempting to recover from the archives. And it certainly came as great news to lots of people in Central Maine that this kind of history lay in the past of their communities.
Yeah, there's no celebration of that violence as there is celebration of the violence here. There are still celebrations of anti-rent movement in Rensselaer County every year. They hold an anti-rent rally.
Well, I should have to go and see what this rally looks like. My bet is that the violence is recalled in demarcated ways that emphasize humor, that do not focus on bloodshed. Not that there was very much bloodshed. Even in that case, there's an attempt to stop short of bloodshed. But still, there's not going to be a full memory of everything that went on, because we don't like to think of our forebears as being involved in this kind of collective violence that is frustrating the rule of law, because they found the rule of law to be unjust.
Indeed, some of the very compromisers who come along and give something to these people who have been wanting the land at reasonable terms, as they would see it, they also insist on laws that would suppress this kind of rural violence, that they insist on masking laws, and the equivalent of the English Black Act, though goes not anywhere near as far as the Black Act.
That's quite right. I mean, it's the job of political leaders to try to keep a lid on these sorts of things that might otherwise corrode the political system. And so they are offering compromises, but the price of that is that this kind of business has got to stop. And they generally will find some support among these leading men of these communities who also want to make sure that there's stability that will follow.
So in many ways, without intending to, you've actually told the rural version of how the people out of doors have been taken out of the body politic, something we know about in the urban mob in the later 19th century, but you're showing it happening earlier on in the rural setting.
Yeah. We tend to have what by 18th century standards would be a narrow definition of politics. It's institutionalized. In the 18th century, there was an understanding of politics in Britain and in the colonies, which included action out of doors, people doing things we would call riots. But the riots of the 18th century were relatively tame affairs compared to what we know of as riots, in which significant numbers of people can get killed. In a way, there was a culture of the riot in the 18th century that was highly controlled. People didn't have, or they didn't bring, firearms when they were rioting. They ordinarily didn't bring knives. If they brought any weapon, it was a stick. It would be a good size stick. And generally you are attacking property rather than people. You're knocking down a fence, you're tearing down a building, you're destroying somebody's carriage, you're making a symbolic statement. And common people who didn't feel that the electoral process was really representing their wishes or was providing a vehicle for them to protest things they disliked, felt they had a right to go and attack property in these symbolic actions. One of the consequences of the American Revolution is that the new Republican regime, and I'm using Republican small r, not a reference to the contemporary party, the new Republican regime says, you now have the perfect opportunity to express your political wishes within the framework of institutionalized politics, and therefore it is now illegitimate for you to engage in this kind of collective crowd violence, even if it's limited violence, anymore.
And they, you know, they're saying you are the people you govern, and there are mechanisms beyond just voting. You can also petition the authorities. Petitioning is a big part of the 18th century state, and it has a special meaning to the people of the early republic.
Well, certainly, petitioning, though, is a very old right, and certainly existed in colonial America. But I think the primary difference is that almost all of the political institutions after the revolution are, in theory, founded on the sovereignty of the people. So, for example, in the colonial period, your governor, you had no vote for that governor. That governor was appointed by the crown bureaucracy and served at the will of the crown. After the revolution, in almost all state constitutions, a fairly wide electorate of men only, and only men usually with some significant property, meaning approximately a farm, but that kind of electorate, which is broad by 18th century standards, could now choose their governor. And so now the argument that's made is when you can elect your governor as well as your legislature, then these kinds of crowd actions that might have seemed necessary before the revolution now are not legitimate after the revolution.
And by the late 19th century, the early 20th century, these kind of crowd actions, this kind of rough community justice is actually seen as barbaric and as almost primitive, because some of the same dynamics you've talked about here in central New York and in central Maine play out in the Appalachian Mountains in the 1880s, 90s, into the turn of the century. And the American image of that is of the Hatfield and McCoy feud, for instance.
Certainly. There are some forms of rural resistance that do persist. The example you gave of Appalachia and in urban or suburban America of the early 20th century, that stuff seems very backward. But there's all sorts of violence in urban America at the same time. And reputable middle-class Americans are not always pure. And there are plenty of examples. You can take the Tulsa race riot, in which people who consider themselves quite upstanding will look the other way while a significant number of black Americans have their property destroyed and their lives lost. So collective violence has never entirely vanished from America, and even people that we would expect in most circumstances would decry this kind of violence have in some cases participated or looked the other way in this violence.
So in some ways the myth makers about the frontier are right, that violence is in part of the frontier story, though not as big as they often would make it, but it's also part of the bigger American story. If we're going to talk about the frontier, I want to return to land, and I want to it's really an unfair question, and so you really don't have to answer it if you don't want to. But the very areas you have studied also become areas of industrialization later on. The land is again transformed one generation past from when you stop looking at it. And I noticed, I was rereading Liberty Men and Great Proprietors, and I noticed that one of the people who buys out Henry Knox is David Sears. And David Sears is one of the members of 50 Associates. They, you know, they build Lowell. They build the mill towns that transform America. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, certainly a lot of the capital that is generated by this kind of rural development by the early 19th century, it's looking for new opportunities for investment and finds it in industrialization. This process of industrialization doesn't mean that places like central Maine or central New York are going to be uniformly experience this transition to an industrial landscape. The places that I study are actually, by the standards of industrializing America, backwaters. And their experience then with the industrialization that's happening nearby is a differential one. Some people will be in a good position to serve this development of a more industrial urban America by providing, for example, by shifting to dairy farms, specializing in that, providing milk and cheese, products that will not at that time bear long-distance transportation because there's not refrigeration yet. But it's going to put at a great disadvantage people who were more traditional farmers who are aligned upon raising grains, because they find that they cannot compete with the farmers of the Midwest that now have access by first canal system and then by railroad to this industrializing, urbanizing America. So that there is going to be a lot of losers and some winners as well in rural America, especially the Northeast, as industrialization develops in pockets of the Northeast.
I think we've run out of time.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
The fame of its fruit through the nations around to seek out his peaceable shore. Unmindful of names or distinction, they came, for freemen like brothers agree. With one spirit endowed, they one friendship pursued, and their temple was liberty free. Beneath this fair branch, like the patriarchs of old, their bread in contentment they eat, unwearied with trouble.